You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, as kids return to daycare centers, we'll find out why clear face shields might be best when interacting with young children. First, after being sidelined by the coronavirus since the middle of March, Wisconsin is getting ready for sports again, but it's going to have quite a different look. The Milwaukee Brewers are holding spring training in the summer at Miller Park instead of in Arizona in front of cardboard cutouts of fans. The Milwaukee Bucks are in Orlando, along with the rest of the NBA, living and working in an area the league has dubbed the bubble. Lambeau Field may have lots of empty seats this fall. That Wisconsin Badgers-Notre Dame football game at Lambeau, not going to happen. And a major golf event in Wisconsin gets pushed back to next year. Megan Hart is Wisconsin Public Radio sports reporter in Green Bay. Megan, good to have you back with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to specifics, Megan, how does it feel to actually be able to cover actual sports again?
It is very exciting. It's very different. As you said, as sports make their return, a lot of things are going to be different. I'm doing a lot of media availabilities over Zoom, but I'm just really looking forward to games getting started.
Let's start with the Brewers. They've been practicing at Miller Park since the beginning of the month. What kind of precautions are they, and I guess other teams, taking when it comes to the virus?
Yeah, it's been great to see the action getting started over at Miller Park. Major League Baseball put together a pretty comprehensive safety plan that the Brewers and other teams have to follow. Some of it is fairly common sense, like no spitting or chewing tobacco, no high fives or fist bumps. Some of it might be harder for players to get used to. They won't have access to all the same amenities that they normally do. They've even been discouraged from showering at the clubhouse, for example. Some of the precautions will affect them when they travel. Teams have been asked to stay at hotels with private entrances, so that way players don't interact with the general public going in and out of hotels. And of course, testing is an important part of their safety plan. So players are being tested every other day for the new coronavirus. A lot of staff members are being tested multiple times per week. And players are supposed to be tested for antibodies once a month as well.
The regular season is set to begin a week from Friday, I think it is. Brewers down in Chicago. How's it going to be different apart from what you just said? That's already a lot.
Yeah, it's going to be very different. So they are set to start next Friday. The biggest difference is that they're going to play 60 regular season games instead of the usual 162. So it's a much shorter season. Limit travel as a safety precaution. Teams are mostly going to play divisional games, and then they'll play like some regional opponents. So for the Brewers, that would be Detroit or Minnesota. And then because they had a shortened spring training, if you will, even though it's not happening in the spring, they've also taken some steps to kind of limit wear and tear on players. So the National League is actually going to have a designated hitter this year, for example. All of the games that go to extra innings, they're going to start the inning with a runner on second. So it'll be really interesting to see what it turns out like.
And as of now, no fans in the stands, is that right?
Yeah. So Rick Schlesinger, who's the director of business operations for the Brewers, he spoke to reporters right after Major League Baseball announced that it was coming back. And he said he made it sound like it was kind of an aspirational goal to maybe at some point this season have some fans. So for now, no fans. A lot of it comes down to kind of local ordinances as far as whether teams could even have fans or not. Like you mentioned, they are going to have cutouts of fans in the stands. And I think that those are still available, and the Brewers also announced today something I'm very excited about, which is you can get cutouts of your pets in the stands as well. So that's new. So it'll be interesting to watch. Last night they played an inter-squad game that was televised, and they had fan noises piped in. So it at least sounds like something. It's not just pure silence, but it will be very different.
Now, baseball, I mean, that sounds really different. Let's turn to basketball and the Bucks and the NBA now. That's going to be really different in a lot of ways. Tell us about the bubble.
Yeah, so the NBA has taken a different approach. They're actually going to finish out their season at one site, And that will be Walt Disney World in Orlando. And I just think it's such an interesting situation they have going down there. The Bucks got there last Thursday. Every player had to quarantine in his hotel room until he tested negative for coronavirus twice. And so then they were able to get out and practice Saturday. But it's they've taken lots of precautions. Each team is only allowed to bring 35 people, and that includes players. So not even all of the coaching staff gets to go into the bubble. They're using some really interesting technology. So in addition to regular coronavirus testing, players have the option to wear a smart ring that measures like their respiratory rate and their heart rate, and it can help them detect coronavirus early. Players have the option of also wearing an alarm on their clothing that notifies them if they have been standing within 6 feet of someone else who is also wearing an alarm for more than 5 seconds. And I think staff are required to wear those. So they've got some cool technology at work trying to keep players safe. And in a lot of ways, like this situation just kind of reminds me of like an adult summer camp. The players have access to a 24-hour lounge where they can play video games or ping pong. They can go boating. Some players have posted videos on social media of them fishing or playing cornhole. Each team has its own culinary staff from Disney to make sure that all of their dietary needs are met. They can reserve the Disney restaurants that they want to go to. So it's a really different situation. And of course, coronavirus cases in Florida have been surging, so it's not a foolproof plan, but Bucks general manager John Horst spoke to reporters last week, and he told us that that in some ways, even though they are in the heart of Florida, that maybe this Disney site will be one of the safest places you could be right now.
Before we move on from the Bucks, they were having a good season. I know, everything's up in the air now after this long break. They still expected to be a top team?
Yeah. Of course, like you said, it's been a long break, and so anything could happen when games get started again. But I think the Bucks are considered a pretty heavy favorite to come out of the East and go up against one of the teams from Los Angeles, either the Lakers or the Clippers, who are considered favorites to come out of the West. And the playoff format, they're going to have a shortened regular season, but the playoff format will be as normal. So it's still going to be 4 series, best of 7. So there'll be a lot of hopefully good basketball to watch in the next few months.
We're talking to WPR sports reporter Megan Hart about what is and isn't happening in the sports world in the coming months. So those are the two happening things going on now, the baseball, the basketball. Let's look ahead a little bit now, Megan. The Packers, the NFL is, I think, still planning to play, but we might not have that full fan experience at Lambeau.
Yeah, the NFL is still planning to play its season as scheduled for right now. But the Packers actually announced today that they are not going to have fans at the one preseason game that they're going to host. They also are not going to have fans at their training camp, which is kind of a blow for up here in Green Bay where I'm located, because it brings a lot of people and is really good for our economy up here. Still no official word yet on what the regular season will look like. The Packers did send a letter earlier this month to season ticket holders that said that it's likely, if they're able to play in front of fans at all, that it will be a reduced capacity crowd. They're going to give season ticket holders the opportunity to either opt in or opt out of trying to attend games this year. They said that if they are able to have fans, that they will be required to wear face coverings, which in the winter and at Lambeau Field, they might want to do anyway. But they also acknowledged that there is a possibility that they won't have fans this year. The NFL hasn't given teams, from what I understand, a whole lot of guidance aside from that they shouldn't have fans sit close to the sidelines to protect players and personnel on the field. But some teams have talked about what they are going to do for the regular season. I'm from Northeast Florida, so the Jacksonville Jaguars said they're going to do 25% capacity, and that kind of seems like a best case scenario at this point.
And let's touch in on a couple other things real quick, Megan. Ryder Cup, the golf tournament scheduled to be held in Kohler, postponed.
Yeah, it's a shame. I was really excited about that. It was supposed to bring 40,000 people a day and over $100 million to the Sheboygan area. It is a biennial event, so they have decided that they're going to skip it for this year, hold it in Kohler next year, and then push back subsequent Ryder Cups. So the next one would then be in 2023 in Rome, Italy. But from what I understand, businesses down there were happy about the news because they were expecting some kind of news, and for them, postponed is a lot better than canceled.
And then Badgers, college sports, Big Ten, looks like conference only.
Yeah, so conference only for the regular season. Of course, that's for this fall, which includes football season. So we don't have a revised schedule for the Badgers yet this football season, but I believe that the team official or athletic department officials haven't closed the door on the possibility that if the Badgers have a good season in the Big Ten, that they may be able to take part in postseason play if it does happen. But I think that over the next few months, we're going to get a lot more news about college sports. This is probably not the last sort of shakeup that we'll see in terms of how college sports or if college sports are able to take place this fall.
Well, Megan, someday we'll talk to you about actual sports on the field instead of all the planning here. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Megan Hart is Wisconsin Public Radio sports reporter based in Green Bay. We talked to her about the Brewers, Bucks, Packers, and Badgers as they get ready to begin their seasons amid the coronavirus. We also touched on the Ryder Cup, as we just heard, being pushed back to next year at Whistling Straits in Kohler. Coming up, we'll find out what type of face covering might be best when working with young children during the coronavirus pandemic. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get the latest on several top stories out of Washington, including an unconventional press conference the president held in the Rose Garden yesterday afternoon. First, more leaders are encouraging people to wear masks, and some employers and municipalities in Wisconsin now require them. The face coverings can lower the chances that we will spread the new coronavirus. With that increased safety comes a drawback, especially for young children. They're not supposed to wear masks, and they can miss out on important visual cues when they can't see adult faces. Lisa Scott is a researcher and professor of psychology at the University of Florida. She works to understand how infants, children, and adults learn about the visual world. She talked recently with WPR host Keely Boltina.
What do babies learn from looking at adult faces?
Babies learn an enormous amount of information from faces. And so we developmental psychologists, think of faces as a learning tool, just like a book might be a learning tool for babies and children. When you see a face, you see the mouth move, and babies use the mouth to help them learn language and help them sort of discern the difference between different sounds. Babies use the eyes when they're trying to figure out what they need to pay attention to. And when the whole face moves together, they learn about things like emotions and identity of people, especially when people are paired with names.
And how do we actually know that that's how the learning happens?
These studies have been done for decades, and we use multiple methods. One of the traditional methods that is used to understand how babies learn from faces is to just look at how long they look at certain things. So we know that babies tend to like to look at things that are new or novel. And so if you pair two faces together, you would see that they would look longer at the new picture or the novel picture if they can tell the difference between those two. Or if something is highly familiar, like their mother's face, they might look more to their mother's face because it's very familiar. And so we can capitalize on these types of preferences to make inferences about the things that babies might know. So that's one method. The other method that have been used more recently is to use eye tracking. So we can use eye tracking to look at where on a picture babies are attending. If they're looking at the eyes or they're looking at the mouth, we can play videos and see which parts of that video they look at. And then finally, we also use EEG. So we have measures of brain activity. So we place just a little net of recording sensors on their scalp, and we can show them pictures paired with names or labels, pictures of things that they may have learned in a book previously or that they may have seen previously. And then we can compare their brain activity to new things.
So then what do you worry about when it comes to challenges as people are masking up, covering their noses and their mouths to try to stop the spread of disease?
Yes, well, we know that in the home, babies get to see a lot of the mom and fathers and brothers and sisters and all caregivers when they're in the home, and they learn quite a bit from their caregivers that they see quite a bit. That, I think, is important for babies to continue to see those types of faces moving and laughing and expressing and talking. As we start to transition back to sending our kids to daycare and pre-kindergarten and, even school-age kids, covering up the mouth, it leads babies to miss out on visual cues that they would typically get from faces. So when the mouth is moving, babies use that to try and understand language, to try and disambiguate the difference between the sound ba and da, for example, especially in noisy environments or in other types of environments, they really rely on the mouth for language development. When we cover up the mouth, it seems that they're not going to get that information. And that doesn't mean that they won't learn language. Of course, they'll still learn. It's just a little bit harder and taxing for them to do so.
What are our options then? Because you're not suggesting people taking care of small children go without masks.
No. I think that recommendations from the CDC seem to be very clear in terms of masks, and we should be using masks. But there are some masks that are available and face shields that are available that are clear or transparent. And I think there's a lot of room for innovation in this area. And so what I would suggest is that we start to see whether we can use clear masks that are also safe and protecting the teachers and the children, but that allow infants to see the mouths move. And these are already being used within the deaf and hard of hearing communities. So I think that we recommend that child care facilities and other early learning centers begin to use these masks also.
Lisa Scott is a researcher and professor of psychology at the University of Florida. She studies how infants, children, and adults learn about the visual world. And we're talking about the effect that caregivers wearing face masks could have on babies. This is the Ideas Network. Lisa, I talked with a pediatrician who said masks do cover up much of the face, but he's found he can interact even with a six-month-old well because of eye contact. How crucial is it to see those eyes?
It's very crucial to see the eyes. I think that the eyes provide a huge amount of information. So when I look across the room or I look at something, infants can use my direction of gaze to direct their own attention and learn about something. Or if I'm labeling an object and I look at it, babies might be able to then map that word or that label to the object that I've named when I'm directing my attention. Also, when the eyebrows go up, it's likely that the person is smiling, and you can begin to tell when people have masks on that they're smiling. But it's a slightly different cue. It's kind of a little bit harder to tell with the mask. But I think the eyes are really critical for learning about emotions and intentions and where to direct their own attention. And so, but that's a little bit different from how babies use the mouth, which is for language development.
Clear masks, though, they tend to be more expensive than paper ones or the cloth masks that people are making themselves. How do you want us to think about balancing the actual costs with the benefits that babies could get by figuring something else out?
One of the reasons why I thought that it was important to get this information out is so that there might be some innovation around clear masks that might sort of address some of those issues, because I do think that it's important if we can have clear masks around kids. Of course, you know, if that's not possible, I think they're going to learn just as well. There just might be some delays, and there might be some extra care that teachers and caregivers are going to have to take to make sure that, you know, that babies are seeing faces and getting that kind of experience.
And you don't want to increase screen time, but that's what popped into my head when you're saying if you can't see it physically and you need to see someone talking, we do have videos, or I guess maybe FaceTime with family members, or more time interacting at home without those masks. Are those things that parents can do?
Yeah, well, I would suggest that the home environment, a lot from live people, is the best way to interact with babies. And, you know, if you just build that into your routine or your schedule to have some time, it's almost like, you know, they suggest that you have tummy time. You could also schedule in some FaceTime where you're just sitting and playing face-to-face, talking, you know, making facial expressions and playing with infants, and then maybe reading a book to them, or, you know, interacting with them at that level. I think that would be useful regardless of whether they are exposed to masks most of the day or not.
Sure, but also really intentionally doing that, not just talking to your young one when you're making dinner, but also looking at them and talking to them for a longer amount of time than maybe you might normally.
Yes. Yeah, I would say that's important, and that, you know, parents and caregivers can strive to do that normally, but, you know, especially now.
Lisa, thank you for breaking this down for us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Lisa Scott talking to WPR host Keely Baltina. They talked about clear masks and why they could be a good solution for people who work with kids. Lisa is a researcher and professor of psychology at the University of Florida. You can read her full article on clear face masks online. We've got a link at WPR.org/centraltime. Coming up after the news, a few more states held primaries yesterday. We'll look at the results and what they could mean for November's elections. That's part of our weekly look at the latest news in national politics. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. Come on Central Time here on the ID. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, under new federal guidelines, hospitals will bypass the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention when they report data on COVID-19 cases to the federal government. We'll find out why the move has some health experts worried. First, it's our look at the week in Washington with top stories from the nation's capital. While states in different parts of the country are seeing cases of COVID-19 going up, members of the Trump administration have made an effort to discredit the country's top infectious diseases expert. Primaries yesterday set up additional races for November that could impact the makeup of the U.S. Senate. And we get another get-out-of-jail order from the president, this time for longtime friend and advisor Roger Stone. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the president have commuted Roger Stone's sentence, right or wrong call? Is this an abuse of power or righting a wrong? Should Stone be investigated and charged again, as some people are saying, in connection with WikiLeaks and Russian interference in the 2016 election? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Ginger Gibson is Deputy Washington Editor for NBC Digital. Ginger, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, the president had this press conference yesterday in the Rose Garden. We'll get into some of what it ended up being in a little bit. He mentioned both the signing of a law and an executive order aimed at penalizing Chinese leaders and mainland China over the treatment of people and protesters in Hong Kong. Can you tell us, Ginger, some of what these actions do?
That's right. The president trying to again take a or appear to take a tough stance on China. He has tried to make this one of his top reelection issues, signing this executive order, although there is some question about whether or not he has the complete authority to do so without Congress's approval, that would impose further limits on China, particularly in our financial system, in response to some of the crackdown that has been taking place in Hong Kong. This was something that President Trump has at times struggled with. He has not wanted to impose further limits on China while negotiating with them on trade, but then in turn has been critical, for example, of their handling of coronavirus and its spread. So this was another iteration, another step in the president's sort of complicated relationship with China.
Let's give a listen to the president talking in the part of the Rose Garden talk that focused on China itself. Here's a listen.
We've all watched what happened. Not a good situation. Their freedom's been taken away, their rights have been taken away, and with it goes Hong Kong, in my opinion, because it will no longer be able to compete with free markets. A lot of people will be leaving Hong Kong, I suspect. And we're going to do a lot more business because of it, because we just lost one competitor.
How much of the Rose Garden announcement about Hong Kong and China stuck with Hong Kong and China?
Very little. it was a meandering, at times rambling press conference by the president, who is known for giving sort of meandering, rambling public appearances. And this one stood out even for him. He went on at length about Joe Biden. He sometimes deviated into coronavirus and testing. He went on to a number of tangents in what was nearly an hour or more than an hour long appearance. One person I saw said it was at times as if he was the person who was supposed to speak after him was running late and he was trying to stall. It just sort of meandered for quite some time.
The president pivoted on China to attacking his now almost certain presidential opponent, Joe Biden. Here's a listen to that.
In contrast, Joe Biden's entire career has been a gift to the Chinese Communist Party and to the calamity of errors that they've made. They made so many errors, and it's been devastating for the American worker. China has taken out hundreds of billions of dollars a year from our country, and we rebuilt China. I give them all the credit in the world. I don't give the credit for the people that used to stand here because they allowed this to happen where hundreds of billions of dollars were taken out of the United States Treasury in order to rebuild China.
The president apparently referring to the trade imbalance, not the U.S. Treasury there. But Ginger, how much of this, again, Rose Garden official ceremony focused on Joe Biden in particular?
Overwhelmingly seemed to focus on Joe Biden. He kept coming back to criticize his opponent. That in turn drew criticism because historically presidents have opted not to use sort of the official parts of the White House, things like Rose Garden press conferences and the briefing room and the East Room as the place to make their political attacks. You know, they've reserved those for campaign events when they're outside the grounds of the Capitol, of the White House. And so it was a bit surprising and I suppose jarring for some to see the president spend so much time at an official White House event where he was signing something to talk about his opponent, Joe Biden. And it wasn't just on China. I mean, he attacked Joe Biden's fitness. He attacked Joe Biden's campaigning. He attacked Joe Biden on sort of a number of fronts. But as you pointed out, also on China, my colleagues have a story that published yesterday about Trump's real struggle to land a punch on Joe Biden and to find a message that he thinks can stick and that will work. I, along with two of my coworkers today, have a story looking just at his attacks on Joe Biden's being senile that just published this afternoon. An attack that his aides keep telling him is actually backfiring and not working. And we saw some of that yesterday in the Rose Garden. So really just sort of Trump meandering around a list of attacks, including some his aides are telling him aren't working.
Right, your NBC colleagues in that first piece you mentioned actually heard this from Republican strategists, that they were concerned that the president wasn't finding lines of attack that stuck on Joe Biden.
That's right. I mean, we're looking at polling numbers that you would think, given the millions of dollars that the Trump campaign has spent in the last 6 weeks, would have moved the dial. And instead, Trump's numbers are getting worse. They attacked Joe Biden over $5 million in ads on his position on defunding police departments, a position that Biden hasn't even taken, but a sort of a very kind of scary, dark ad that shows a telephone ringing to a police department and going unanswered to report crimes along with protests. And instead, we're seeing polls where people trust Biden more than they trust Trump to handle issues like policing. So these just don't appear to be working at all for him and his reelection bid at this time.
Talking to Ginger Gibson from NBC Digital, looking at some of the top stories in national politics. In just a few minutes, we'll look at the president's decision late last week to commute the sentence of his longtime advisor, Roger Stone. You can join in on that with your reaction. Good idea, abuse of power, somewhere in between. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Some elections yesterday, Ginger, not necessarily the most high profile ones. The one I think most watched in Alabama, the Republican Senate primary. Tell us about this one.
Jeff Sessions' political career may officially be over after the Republican Senate primary in Alabama last night was settled not in his favor. Jeff Sessions, many may remember, was the U.S. Senator from Alabama for 20 years. He was the first member of the U.S. Senate to endorse President Trump's bid for president in his campaign. He was probably the most high-profile person at the point that he did endorse him. Very loyal early on to President Trump. President Trump named him the Attorney General. And then things went very badly for Jeff Sessions when he refused to unrecuse himself from the overseeing the investigation, the Mueller investigation into President Trump's campaign and their dealings with Russia. President Trump fired Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions decided to run for his old Senate seat, which got run by a Democrat, which is an anomaly in Alabama, and has now lost his primary for that seat to Tommy Tuberville, the former football coach who coached at Auburn University there in Alabama. So President Trump endorsing Tuberville, campaigning for him, pretty aggressively calling for his supporters to back the former football coach. So was a big, big fall for Jeff Sessions, who was once quite popular in the state of Alabama.
There was less drama in Maine with the Democratic primary, but now we have the race shaping up for what some people say is a seat that may be hard for Republicans to defend for Republican Senator Susan Collins. What are we watching for there over the next few months?
That's right. Susan Collins has kind of long had a very moderate independent streak. She's appealed to the state's independence. Sarah Gideon, who was a leader in the state house, won this primary. She was expected to win, but this sets up what could be the most competitive Senate race for Republicans trying to hold this seat. Sarah Gideon's quite popular. She's running as pretty liberal. She's criticizing Collins' vote for Brett Kavanaugh and her role in the impeachment trials. I mean, she really is going to try to do what has not been capable, Democrats not been capable before, which is sort of win over those independents who had sided with Susan Collins in the past and go after her for being in the party of Trump.
We are talking to Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor for NBC Digital. It's our weekly look at the latest stories in national politics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We are going to talk about the commutation of the sentence of Roger Stone, longtime advisor. He was charged for charges related to the Russia investigation, the interference in the 2016 presidential campaign. The president commuted his sentence. Want to get your reaction to that and the president's use of powers of pardon and commutation in general. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ginger Gibson from NBC Digital. It's the week in Washington. Our look at several top stories from the nation's capital. Let's bring on a caller to start us off on our next topic, looking at the commutation of the sentence of Roger Stone. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hello.
Hello. I think, you know, just when I think you can't go any lower, this is so corrupt. It's a new level of corruption, even for this president, who's corrupt in so many ways and always shatters the norms of what's considered normal behavior in this country, in this democracy, that he would, they have the power to commute a sentence, but no president has ever commuted a sentence of someone who is convicted of crimes directly involving the president's campaign and is a close personal friend of the president since he was a young man. So this is shocking, I think. Shocking and sort of a mob-like behavior.
Willem, thanks for the call. Ginger, talk a little bit about that commutation and the reaction.
Well, the president had been hinting that this commutation was coming for some time, had been defending Roger Stone, saying that he had been unfairly targeted, calling the entire investigation a hoax and suggesting he had been wrapped up in this hoax. So it didn't really surprise any of us that the president would have commuted the sentencing. In fact, we thought he was going to go farther for a long time and expected him to completely pardon Roger Stone. Sources telling us that there was some effort to convince the president to sort of split the two and not go so far as to pardon and just prevent his, as the caller mentioned, his friend Roger Stone from going to jail, which he did. We expected to hear more of an argument from the president and his allies that this was to keep Roger Stone safe, that he is not a young man and that going to jail in the time of a pandemic or prison in a time of a pandemic would have risked his life. We didn't hear that argument, mostly because Trump took to Twitter and sort of drowned out that argument by arguing instead that this was about what he calls a hoax investigation into his campaign. So it is really unprecedented. But again, a president that sort of has shattered a lot of norms and that says what he wants and does what he wants and had been telegraphing that this was coming for a long time, such that it wasn't much of a surprise.
Thanks for that call, Willem. We'll go to Jay now in Two Rivers. Jay, hello.
Good afternoon. Well, I think it's pretty easy to tell what is right and wrong that President Trump does. He's almost completely accurate in that whatever he says or does is the opposite of what should be said or done. So his pardoning of Roger Stone, of course, is absolutely politically motivated and just sets the worst example from the very top. And gives me very little hope for any fairness as long as Trump is in office.
Jay, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We saw Robert Mueller weigh in on this, saying, hey, Stone is still a felon, technically. And people have been pointing to Roger Stone saying before the commutation, hey, I didn't cooperate with the investigation into the president, so I'm kind of expecting to be rewarded for that, in effect. I'm paraphrasing heavily, Ginger.
That's right. Stone did sort of say what everyone was thinking, that he had not cooperated, that he was not going to be party to this. And it sort of leaves open other questions about other sort of characters or figures involved in this investigation. We've seen Paul Manafort, his former campaign manager, who he has been, the president has been publicly defensive of, and Michael Flynn, who was a campaign advisor, who also was sort of part of this investigation, who said that, who has pled guilty at one point to lying to investigators and then cooperated and then stopped cooperating and then revoked his guilty plea. And that has created a lot of questions that as the president has defended Roger Stone, as the president has defended Michael Flynn, that he could be setting up also a pardon or commutation, a pardon because he's not been convicted of anything of Michael Flynn.
Thanks a lot for that call. We are talking about some of the top stories in national politics. Ginger Gibson is with us, deputy Washington editor for NBC Digital. Now, here's a story. It's still developing today. Efforts by some in the administration, the Trump administration, to discredit Dr. Anthony Fauci. what kind of things have we seen over the last handful of days?
That's right. There's a piece that my coworker Shannon Pettypiece has just published on NBCNews.com looking sort of more broadly at this multi-day effort that we now see from the White House and a little bit of a world of them trying to have it both ways. We saw the president, we saw the White House press shop came out with this detailed sort of opposition research, this attack on Fauci, and then came back a couple days later and said, oh, no, we weren't trying to discredit him. And then we saw Peter Navarro, who is a close aide to the president, who has the president's ear, who is simpatico with the president on a number of fronts, published today in USA Today or last night. This piece just really attacking Anthony Fauci. And then the White House press office came back and said, oh, we didn't approve that we didn't sign off on that. That wasn't ours. So a little bit of trying to, you know, tell it both ways. The president saying that he likes Fauci, although he disagrees with him. But we really see the fraying of this relationship there. We saw Fauci saying also today that he called these attacks bizarre, continuing to say the things he knows that the president doesn't want him to say about the economy, about face masks. So really has sort of meandered into a place that was maybe not unexpected given the way the president has handled people in the past, but surprising given the level of respect that Anthony Fauci has commanded from people for a long time in his role as the head of the Infectious Disease Center.
And we've heard that Dr. Fauci hasn't been in contact with the president as much lately, not seeing him front and center in public speaking about coronavirus. But then the White House, I'm seeing on social media, there's a picture with Vice President Pence and Dr. Anthony Fauci kind of center of the frame. So again, that kind of mixed feelings there.
It is a mixed feelings. I mean, I think that they want to undermine him without getting rid of him. They want to get rid of the pieces of advice or the recommendations he's making that they don't like without having to take the drastic step of, say, firing him or removing him from the coronavirus task force. To be clear, the president wants the economy open. He wants people out buying things. He views his political future as very important, very hinged and determined by the way that the economy is when we vote in 3.5 months, and continued efforts to stall that process, that recovery process, he really views as a political crisis for himself, and has at times really tried to take over the process and at other times tried to completely surrender it to others, this sort of overseeing the response and the recovery. So a bit of trying to get it so that they don't get rid of Anthony Fauci because that would be a political risk, but they don't listen to what he's telling them to do because they view that also as a political risk.
Now, Ginger, in our last couple minutes, I know the coronavirus is hitting a city near and dear to your heart, Houston, these days. What are you watching for in Texas and on the national front when it comes to the efforts against COVID-19?
Well, I, like so many Americans, are watching for baseball. is part of the reason that Houston is near and dear to my heart. Ready to see baseball return, but I think that I think what we're watching for on the coronavirus front is how the response is being handled in places that are hard hit. Are they running out of PPE? There was some concern in this last week that places like Houston have switched from trying to make sure they have enough to conserving, that they now don't have enough. They're having to reuse some PPE. And I think we're hearing messaging from people to say, look, if everyone just put a mask on, we could be back to normal pretty quickly. And does that message get through? When I look at the Gulf Coast, where I'm from, I think there's a big struggle right now about what we should be doing and how we should be responding. And then I think the next week or two, probably going to play out as to whether or not people embrace those recommendations and start really wearing masks or don't. And then we might see this continue to spread into the fall and winter.
Ginger, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Ginger Gibson, Deputy Washington Editor at NBC Digital. She was with us to look at some of the top stories in national politics, including the commutation of Roger Stone's sentence, a White House Rose Garden speech, and White House moves to punish China for its treatment of Hong Kong. What is on your radar when you're watching national news from your Wisconsin vantage point? What is the most important issue for you? What do you want to see the White House and Congress doing to tackle COVID-19 and the economic fallout from that? What do you want the presidential candidates to be talking about in the next couple of weeks? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. Again, email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. A lot of people are using online communication in a lot of different ways for work, school, and connecting with friends and family. Yesterday, two Wisconsin therapists told us how they're using teletherapy for their clients, and the Milwaukee Brewers had a mid-game Zoom chat for fans during spring training this week. At WPR, we're doing a lot of this too. Our engineers and computer experts have done a lot of work to make sure we can do many of our jobs on the air or behind the scenes with as little contact as possible, and we've come up with some new ways to get guests on the air too. We're going to test a backup technology right now on the air. Producer Jay Carlisle Larson is helping with this test. JC, can you hear me? JC, can you hear me? This is a live radio test of new technology to us, and it's not working. Oh, okay. Well, you got to experience
the
drum.
Aha.
Okay, so the thing we were trying didn't work though, JC.
It did not, and this is what we have been learning as we go, as we've been working from home at this point, that sometimes things don't work, just like we just experienced live on the air.
We drew it up. It didn't work. I was going to say one small step for radio, one giant leap for radio kind, but that's going to have to wait. Back to the drawing board, JC.
We will try again, and it will be fine.
All right. We're learning as we go. This is Central Time.